So I'm currently sat in the car park in the pouring rain in Bristol Parkway with producer Ollie on our way to visit this episode's guest, Paul Mundream, aka Mungo, wilderness cameraman extraordinaire. Mungo's been working for over 20 years as a cameraman specialising in adventure TV. He's filmed everywhere from Siberia to Namibia and with everyone from Bear Grylls to Kate Winslet. He also recently stepped out from behind the camera to present Expedition Mungo, which saw him visiting places like Peru, Argentina and Borneo to find the truth behind mythical creatures and legends. On top of all that, he somehow found the time to write two books, Mungo the Cameraman and Living the Dream. I've been working alongside Mungo as safety for many years on projects such as Running Wild with Bear Grylls. We literally get to hang out in the most incredible places all over the world. And when I say hang out, I mean hanging out of helicopters and off the sides of cliffs. I'm so excited to introduce you to Mungo. Let's go. I'm Megan Hine, survival consultant on shows such as Man vs. Wild and Running Wild with Bear Grylls. This is The Power of Adventure, a podcast setting out to find out what adventure really means.
Hey,
how are you?
Good.
You're
really good to see you. Thanks for having us over.
It's quite weird seeing you in this domestic.
I know, it's setting. So strange, isn't it?
Come in.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, you'd be hanging off a cliff somewhere.
Thank you so much for agreeing to chat to us. I'm really excited to bring you into the lives of the listeners. I think your story is so inspirational. But before we delve into Mungo and what makes him tick, as I was coming through the door, I've seen this knife on the side. As being a bit of a knife nerd, I'd love to know like what the history is behind this knife.
Well, the knife it's got a wooden handle and it's like a leather sheath that goes around the calf muscle of someone. And it's actually my grandfather's knife. And he was a Spitfire pilot in the Second World War when he was 19 years old.
Wow.
Flying over France. And when he passed away, my mum grabbed, because I think it was literally going to be chucked out, his leather helmet, his flying helmet, the original one, and this dagger. And it's got a KK, which it's not Ku Klux Klan, don't worry. KK is Ken King, Kenneth King, which was his name.
Wow.
Kind of scratched into it.
It's amazing. This was with him on the Spitfires.
Yeah. That's what they flew with. I think it was more about cutting out rather than stabbing people.
Right, yeah.
So cutting out if you couldn't get out of your...
That was gnarly, wasn't it?
Stopping your parachute or whatever. Yeah. No, it's amazing. So that's kind of a very proud part of my heritage.
So would you say that adventure then was genetically inherent in you, or is this something that has come later on in life?
It's interesting, you know, and I've thought a lot about this in the past because I've written a couple of books, as you know, and it always comes across that I was always, you know, really adventurous, born to do this type thing. Yeah. I was definitely a jock, not wanting to use an American term, but it best describes it, in that I was a sportsman.
Right.
With that, I loved being outdoors. But yeah, my father was a publisher. So he wasn't a great outdoorsman, great sportsman, not a great outdoorsman necessarily. And so I'd never really been exposed to it. But then it was through who I met, a guy called Simon Niblett, who was a renowned documentary cameraman. And when I met him, I just knew that this guy was living my dreams. He owned a Land Rover, Defender. He had a big motorbike. He was traveling the world with all his camera kit, just having wild adventures. And I just thought, this guy's mental. And I thought, you know, something within me kind of woke up.
How old were you at the time?
I was in my early 20s.
Right.
And then, you know, I kind of fell upon this guy, Simon. Yeah, he's just like everything that I kind of wanted to be. And to my delight, we got on like a house on fire. I was a bit like the little brother that he should have had. Anyway, so I hung out with him. I worked as his assistant for just over 2 years. And then he said to me, I think you know enough to start shooting in your own right. So why don't I pass on the work that I no longer want to do to you? And then you can kind of, you know, see how you get on.
Yeah.
So I knew that was my golden opportunity. And it was a real baptism of fire. I never trained to be a cameraman officially.
Yeah.
I did like an apprenticeship with him. So I was his assistant. I cleaned his cars. I cleaned all the stickers off his bags or his flight cases. I made him copious amounts of tea. But it was in the small things that he learned to trust me. And then obviously he'd start giving me more responsibility. Yeah, he's just a great guy. And he taught me with the baptism of fire, threw me in at the deep end.
Yeah.
I once did my first shoot for him. And it was doing a shoot with Cliff Richard and Diane Louise Jordan. And it was in a park up near Highgate somewhere in London. And we went up there and I started setting the camera up and we're doing like a head and shoulders chat between the two of them. Yeah, and I just didn't, now looking back with all I know now, I didn't have a Scooby-Doo what I was doing. And so I took a colour temperature reading, you know, for the white balance to kind of get the colour right. In the camera, it's one of the settings you have to do, and it came up saying 5,000 Kelvin. I thought, what does this mean? I had no idea. So I said to the director, look, I'm just gonna, because I basically blagged my way in, you know, I didn't, obviously I wasn't going to admit that I didn't know what I was doing.
This was before Google as well, like,
so literally was, I mean, we didn't have mobile, actually we did have mobile phones, because I went into a bush, so I said, so I'm just going to dive into the bush for a quick wee before we start, so I don't have to stop and interrupt you. And I dived in there and I said to Si, look, I've just taken a temperature reading and it comes up as 5,000 Kelvin. What does it mean? And he just laughed and put the phone down. So that was kind of how I learned. It was like belt and braces.
But what a great way jumping. Of learning. Because I think so much now, in like when I look at sort of some of the younger generations coming through at the moment, everything is so spoon-fed. There's no room to experiment with that. And it's like,
and make mistakes, which is so important.
Exactly.
I mean, it's the biggest thing. And you know, with him, I'll never forget. And you know, I've quoted it so many times to people like assistants that I now employ. When I say, I don't mind you making a mistake, as long as you don't make the same mistake twice.
Yeah.
Because that's what he told me. Yeah, I did make some massive mistakes, but he didn't mind because he knew that that's how you learn and we've got to learn.
So going back to you here and going back to, so you've met Simon and he's started empowering you and starting to give you these opportunities. At what point did that turn into the adventure filming, which is what you're so renowned for now?
Well, Simon's USP, his unique selling point, was Lonely Planet.
Okay.
So when I was there, he'd started the Lonely Planet shoots. Yeah, so the Lonely Planet thing was what Si was doing. And that was one of the things that he gave me my first real opportunity in. So he said to me, you know, do you want me to put you forward to do one? And I said, well, yeah. I said, if you think I'm up for it. He goes, well, yeah, why not? You know, if I can do it, you can do it type thing, which is a bit of a bold statement because he'd been doing it for about, I don't know, 10 years at a time at least. And I'd been doing it for about 10 months probably. So I went in there and I kind of blagged my way through the interview. I met with two, I'll never forget it. It's kind of an attic room in North London. And we were sat there with these two girls who are older than me, but yeah, quite impressive. Obviously kind of telly types. They kind of knew what they were talking about, I think. And they said to me, you know, well, we've got a shoot coming up in Cambodia. And I thought, great, I've never been to Africa before. And that's how green I was. Yeah, I had no idea about stuff, really. I didn't
and
say
where
that.
Is Cambodia?
Well, it's in Southeast Asia, which now I know because I've been there to do this shoot, thank God. So I really was green. Anyway, so I went in there kind of, I blagged without lying, you know, because I'm not a liar. It goes against everything I believe.
Yeah, sometimes you don't know what you don't know until you're in that situation.
Of course
it is.
And I just swerved the conversation around it. You know?
Yeah. So from Simon and the start with The Lonely Planet, so how did you then get involved with Bear Grylls?
Well, it's worth saying that, just to qualify, that the Lonely Planet shoots, for those who don't know, were about following a traveller who was really a presenter off the beaten track. So it was like a travel guide of a country, but it wasn't luxury. It was about doing it the kind of budget way for students, for travellers. So it was really good fun. You know, so we literally, yeah, we took hammocks, slept on boats, you know, just roughed it, got train journeys to, you know, points of interest within the country. So it was very adventurous. And that really started giving me a taste of travel adventure.
So over the past 20 years, the adventure film industry has taken off massively, like exponentially. It is huge and it seems to be continually growing. Why do you think that is? What do you think it is about adventure films that makes them so popular for people to watch?
Because they're fun. Isn't it? Isn't that the answer? Surely. I mean, yeah, when you do documentaries, they're informative and educational. When you see feature films, they're, you know, experiential. When you see adventure TV or programs, whatever, for me, it's just balls out fun. You know, it's kind of, who wouldn't want to do it? You know, it's aspirational, inspirational. And the beauty is, I think, as technology has helped, and that's including things like world travel, it's just, you know, the world is a small place. It's easy to get around. It's easy to visit the places now. I mean, if you've got a mobile phone and a credit card, you can pretty much go anywhere in the world and do whatever you want. So I think, yeah, it has changed. And the whole adventure TV explosion has happened with regards to travel has become easier. So all these things have become more accessible. Just knowledge, the information about these things, knowledge about what they are, how to do them, where to do them. You know, you can look on, you know, if you want to go base jumping, yeah, you want to go with somebody who knows what they're doing. But you know, you can do it with enough training.
Yeah.
And you could probably, you know, meet somebody from seeing them on a YouTube video, get in touch with them, and they'll probably tell you how to do it.
Yeah.
Which years ago you just couldn't do. It'd be a pipe dream. But also from a camera point of view, obviously, you know, things like GoPros and, you know, even drones now have just made it so easy.
Yeah.
I mean, you can get a GoPro, which is like 4K quality, so ultra HD, ultra high definition. And you can buy a, you know, top of the range one for just over £300. I mean, yeah. It's insane. I mean, whereas, you know, the big cameras we're using are like, you know, at least 30, 40 grand for the body, and then probably 25, 30 grand for the lens. That's not including your batteries, your viewfinder, your monitor, your tripod. So you're talking about probably easily 100 grand's worth of kit.
Yeah.
That we need to do what we're doing.
That's crazy when you're handing it to me, like on a cliff and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't want to touch it.
Yeah.
I don't want to drop
but
it.
But it's all insured. It's not my camera. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. But then that leads me on to like sort of talking about behind the scenes on these shows, because I suppose the viewer doesn't often think about what actually goes in behind the camera. And actually seeing, you know, if I see this firsthand of like Mungo running around in the terrain carrying this massive camera, I mean, how much do those cameras weigh?
Well, they can weigh up to 15 kilograms. Yeah, no, it's true. And you know what? I think with shows like Blue Planet and, you know, the Planet Earth Diaries and stuff like that, where at the end of those big natural history shows, they show the crews. Yeah, and how they do it. I think the public is definitely becoming more media savvy. So when they do see a shot, they do think about the camera, about the cameraman or
yeah.
the people behind the scenes. I mean, a lot of what I've done in the publicity that I've got over the years is because I'm Bear Grylls cameraman. Because, you know, when you say, oh, I work with Bear Grylls, I'm his cameraman, they always say, oh, so you're the guy that's doing everything he's doing, but with a camera on your shoulder. And I'm like, well, yeah, I am. I think the key word for me, without wanting to sound too kind of sappy about it, is team. It's all about a team. You know, if the hand isn't doing what the foot's going to do in conjunction with the foot, it's just not going to work. So the analogy of a body, but in the same way, if the camera team isn't working with the safety team, if the director isn't communicating with the cameraman, if the cameraman isn't communicating with the sound man, you know, if there's one bit of discord or disjoint, it's just not going to work. So you have to create an environment where it's such a slick operation that everything just works. I mean, but obviously we're talking super high standard, and the reason why we're operating in that super high standard arena is because we're working with A-list celebrities and we haven't got a lot of time either. So I remember working with Ben Stiller on a Running Wild show, and it was one of the hardest ones we did, actually, because the weather came in and we couldn't get to where we wanted to start because we were going to get heli-bumped to the start of a journey, and we couldn't get heli-bumped there, so we had to climb before we even started, and it was really brutal. But Ben, at the end of the shoot, sat us down. He just said, you know, Bear was interviewing him sort of thing on the beach at the end, and he just said, he kept on coming back to, but I can't believe, you know, your crew has done everything that we're doing, but with these cameras on their shoulder and all this kit in these horrendous conditions. And he said, but what they've shot in this day or 2 days, we would take 2 weeks to do one scene, because that's the difference between movies and reality TV. for want of a better term.
And I think also, I mean, with the Running Wilds with Bear, we shoot linear, don't we? We don't shoot in scenes.
Totally.
So once the action starts at the beginning of the day,
It's live. It is shooting as live.
Yeah.
We don't do anything twice, as you know. and that's one of the reasons why I know I've kept my job and kept that position where I am, is because when you do big stunts, you know, Bear or Channing Tatum are doing backflips from a helicopter into a glacial lake, you can't kind of go, whoops, sorry, slightly out of focus. Bear, will you do it again? It's not going to happen. So you've got to get it right. And that's, again, back to the people you employ and the trust in the team. I remember on that one, Bear, so we're hovering over this glacial lake. I was sitting out with my legs on the, you know, feet on the skids as usual, shooting this kind of side profile from the helicopter. And then, you know, below us was the lake and you could see that, you know, all the wash from the downdraft of the helicopter. It was all very exciting. And we had two other cameras on the ground shooting ground to air. So we had it well covered, GoPros all over the helicopter. And then Bear went first and he kind of said, right, you know, just basically do what I'm doing. So he went out onto the skids, turned backwards and then did a big backflip from the helicopter about, I don't know, 40 feet into this glacial lake, and then swam off like the hero he is. And then it was Channing's turn. And so Channing went out and, you know, the plan was he would just jump in after Bear and do a similar thing. But no. This is Channing Tatum, who's, you know, very capable physically. So he turned around. And at that point, we both thought, shit, you know, he's going to try and do literally what Bear did, a backflip. I remember Dave saying to him, if you're going to do it, don't jump up, jump out. Because if he jumped up, yeah, he'd lose his feet in the props. And of course, being Channing, he did it. He did it perfectly. Yeah. And I think Bear was a little bit gutted. But it was, it was amazing. It really was amazing. But, you know, so it's all about that team, the safety team, the camera crew, the sound department, the, you know, the production team. We have to all be on the same page or it simply doesn't work.
No.
It'd be dangerous. You wouldn't come back with what you need to make the show. And, you know, obviously somebody's spending a lot of money on us being there.
Yeah.
So we've got a responsibility to come back with the goods.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, it's truly incredible because, you know, I spend a lot of time running along behind you to see the weight that I'm carrying and like rigging kit and stuff is on my back, whereas you're carrying a similar amount of weight, but on your shoulder. And, you know, does that take a toll on your body?
Totally. I've had operations on both my knees, both my shoulders. And I'm, you know, the only thing that keeps me lying awake at night, apart from my 2-year-old Gus, is thinking, how much longer can I do this for? How much, yeah, and it's not from want in my mind, but physically, just how much longer can I do it? And I'll keep going as long as I can.
Why? Why? What is it that keeps you going? What is it that draws you to that?
It's all I can do. It's all I can do well that pays me that much money. Well, that is part of it, obviously.
But it's got to be so much more. I mean, the crazy conditions, literally putting your life on the line at times.
Yeah, but I just can't. It's really hard to put in words. It's just something within me, you know, that just loves it. The harder it is, the tougher it is, the more challenging it is. That's what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Yeah.
You know, when we go camping as a family, if we camp in a campsite, I hate it. Because I just want to be on Dartmoor or somewhere wild camping and, you know, swimming in rivers and, you know, I just can't bear it. Don't tell my wife that. whereas I'd rather just be, you know, doing it for real. Yeah, building a shelter, putting up a hammock, getting wet at night or whatever.
So you've mentioned that inside of you there's this inherent drive to find adventure. But how do you find that? So when you're not out there in these fantastical places, how do you meet that very inherent need that you have?
Good question. I lived in London for over 25 years. Now, obviously, we're in Bristol. So we moved here a year ago, which I wish I'd done 15 years ago. But I was stuck in London and I had to be there. You know, London's a great city, particularly when you're young and single. It's a lot of fun. But there was a conflict with living in a big city with being an outdoorsman or wanting to be an outdoorsman. So the way I combated it or kind of satisfied my need and my hunger for it was just by doing simple things. I bought myself a lightweight aluminium Canadian canoe. a Linda canoe. And, you know, any given chance, I would drive down the road to places like Richmond or Hampton or even down to Putney and just put my canoe in the river and take a paddle and just paddle off. And when you're on that river, you kind of forget about where you are and you'd forget about work. You forget about all the things you're kind of troubled with. I know it sounds really twee, but it's absolutely true, hand on heart. And all I cared about was where I was paddling to, what I was looking at. I'd take friends for a paddle and we'd go to a pub in Twickenham and we'd just, you know, pull up along the shore and then go for a pint and then paddle back. And when I was single, I used to take girls there as well. That was my like one of my pulling things. So let's go canoeing first day. What? And they turn up with a canoe on your roof. But you know, in all seriousness, I loved it. And that was a real way of satisfying my need. And the truth is anybody can find adventure, but you just have to be creative. And it doesn't even have to cost a lot of money. You don't have to buy a canoe, which cost me about $1,000. It's been one of the best things I ever bought for investment terms. But you can go and join a canoe club or just hire one, you know, for the day. There's numerous people who do it. Or stand-up paddle boards. That's my next thing, because I've got really into it. And then, yeah, you just find a bit of water. As long as you go somewhere where it's safe and you know what you're doing, just get out there and do it. Even in our own personal lives at home, you know, like me as a dad, you know, it's a challenge for me. What am I going to do with my kids? I mean, Herbie loves nothing more than getting in the front of the canoe and pretending to paddle while I take him down a river. It's just brilliant.
So it is in the genes.
I think it is in the genes, yeah. I hope so. I mean, he loves it, but for him, it's the norm now. So I'm giving him what I never had because, you know, my dad wasn't particularly adventurous. He was very sporty, but he wasn't necessarily adventurous. Whereas now Herbie sees me jump into a river to go swimming. And then he's like, seconds later, he's like, "Mummy, I want to go with Daddy." And so she takes his clothes off and he just launches himself off the bank into my arms. And it's just, you know, that's such a privilege because I know that I'm giving him an outlet to what I would have loved. And I was blessed enough to kind of find my way into it, really.
And has fatherhood changed your outlook on the work that you do and the risks that you take?
It's obviously changed my outlook because it's like a grenade going off in your life. It makes it a lot harder to go away from home. The risks in our job, the risks in my job is the ones that would keep me up at night are less about the helicopters, less about, you know, the big stunts we're doing, rope work, because I know that we've got the best in the business, you know, managing those risks. So I'm less worried about those. For me, it's more about what happens when I'm away or road traffic accidents, you know, which are statistically the most dangerous thing you can do is drive down the road in a car, whether it's here or in the Amazon or wherever. So it's more about things like that. And, you know, all the time when I was single for many years, I mean, I didn't get married till I was in my early 40s. When I went away, I always used to want to have my house in order. So if anything happened to me, people at home knew where everything was. So I used to do an emergency file. Every time I went away, I'd write up this emergency file, like templated. So I'd have where spare keys are to the flat, where my bank details are, what my passport details are. And that obviously worked two ways, because if something happened, like if we got kidnapped, I had a safe word written down. So if we got kidnapped, yeah, they'd know as a proof of life that if I answered this word, it really was me and I was alive. But also had scans of all my documents so I could get my dad to email them to me or whatever. But then when I go away now, I do kind of often, I try to stop myself doing it, but I can't help it. I often think I've got to spend time with Herbie today because what happened if I didn't come home? Yeah. And it kind of breaks my heart to even think about it. But I think it's partly being responsible. So, yeah, I mean, God willing, it'll never happen. But if it does, I want him to know that and Gus, I wanted them to know that I was totally loving them and providing for them where I could. And, yeah, they'll be all right because my life insurance is pretty good.
Okay, so moving on to Expedition Mungo.
Yeah.
So I've been really excited to ask you about this because... So you stepped out from behind the camera to present Expedition Mungo.
Yeah.
What is Expedition Mungo?
Expedition Mungo was a a series for Animal Planet and Discovery, which was 6 1-hours, where me and my crew, as in my TV crew, film crew, we went to 6 different countries. We went to Peru, Argentina, India, Borneo, Liberia, and Namibia. And we were investigating stories where so-called mythological creatures had killed people. So it was like river monsters on acid. And the reason I say that is because there was a serious side. And, yeah, and because people actually had died.
From these creatures?
From creatures. Right. Now, obviously, when we say mythological creatures, that's what the local indigenous people group may believe, that it was something like the pig-headed dog monster. And our job, or my job, was to kind of lead the team and kind of say, well, let's speak to these people. And then let's look at where they live and the environment they're in and say, well, if it wasn't the dog-headed pig monster, what could it have been in the wildlife?
Because yeah. you were right out in the depths of the jungles and
oh, it was full on. I mean, it really was full on.
Yeah.
In some ways, it was a lot harder than what we do with bear because, you know, we were... It wasn't a short, sharp thing. We were in there for a good length of time and, you know, we were really roughing it a lot.
Did it all go to plan?
Not always. I mean, we camped in an area which was... We were looking for snakes. We didn't find any snakes, but we found gazillions of fire ants and mosquitoes. And it was just, you know, hell on earth, really. So it was tough. But it was amazing. It was a really amazing experience. And for me to step out in front of the camera, it genuinely, hand on heart, you have to take my word for it, it wasn't a vanity project. It was a case of, I've obviously worked with presenters for all my career, over 25 years, and I've always kind of thought, I don't always agree what they would say, and I've got my own opinion. But obviously you can never share your opinion because you're behind the camera. You have to keep quiet. So it's quite nice to have the opportunity to actually kind of have your opinion aired and be able to kind of say, well, you know, this is what I think. And it was a really interesting thing. I mean, I like animals. I'm not totally passionate about them. I really like them. I've got pets and stuff. And I've done wildlife shooting before quite a lot, filming that is, not shooting. What I really liked about the series Expedition Mungo was it was about the relationship between local wildlife and the local people.
Yeah.
Because my heart really goes out for people. I just love people and love, you know, I don't know. That's kind of what makes me tick.
Right. Is it indigenous peoples and?
Well, just people in general. Right. I like people. I'm a people person.
Yeah. So for any listeners who are wanting to get into adventure filmmaking, whether on a professional level as you do or on a more amateur level, what are some steps that you would suggest for somebody wanting to take those first steps?
I had a really interesting phone call once where somebody phoned me from Google and they said, would you be willing to come in and train our top vloggers, the video bloggers effectively, about camera skills and how to improve their camera skills? And I said, yeah, fine, yeah. I think I had 4 hours with them, with about 20 young people. And I was like, what am I going to do for 4 hours? I could teach them what I know in about 5 minutes. So I went along there and we sat around in a circle, a bit like Alcoholics Anonymous. And we all said, yeah, I'm Mungo and I'm a cameraman. And they were going around and saying, my name's so-and-so and this is what I do online. This is why I'm kind of here. And the thing that blew me away was... this new digital platform is just extraordinary. It's like a blank canvas for creativity, whether that's with cameras or music or film or paint, whatever you want to do, acting. You can do whatever you want. There are no rules and regulations. It literally is a blank canvas. And that really excites me. Whereas in my career, my professional career, I've been brought up with compliance. You have to do this. You have to keep within these limitations. You know, the shot has to be shot steady or whatever. It has to be 4K. It has to be HD. It has to be this or that, this aspect ratio. But with them, they've got no boundaries. They've got no rules, and they can do whatever they want. So I just think it's a really exciting era to be in for making adventure programs, vlogs, films, podcasts, whatever you want to call it, in whatever guise, because the world is your oyster. And no, not only that, but you don't need to have £100,000 worth of kit. You can literally buy a GoPro, or you can even shoot it on your phone.
Yeah, so true. Thank you so much, Mungo. It's been quite enlightening
talking has it?
To you. Yeah, no, it really
I feel
has.
Like I've just rambled
no,
on.
No, no, it's so interesting, because I think, you know, for the listener as well, most listeners wouldn't know what goes into making these TV shows and what goes on behind it, and, you know, your role within that, which is very central to that whole process, but also the philosophy and the ethos about how to get outside and why, you know, those small steps that you've spoken about, you know, about getting out there into nature and exploring, and how those adventures are on our doorstep. I think there's this sort of fallacy that on social media and things that we have to be going to these far-flung destinations to have adventures, to for our lives to be meaningful, but yeah, it's right here on our doorsteps.
Totally.
And we should be out there exploring those. So I've known Mungo for about 6 or 7 years now, and it's mad because although I work together so much with him, we don't get these opportunities to sit down and chat like this. And actually hearing his story and how he's got to where he is, to being literally the adventure cameraman, it just blows my mind. And, you know, I feel even more fortunate to know such an incredible and inspirational person. Like, the humility just comes across. And, you know, you guys wouldn't be able to see it, but I see it every day on the ground, the way that he treats his teams and the way that he works together with his teams. It's just incredible. And if you ever get the opportunity to sit down and have a beer with Mungo, I would seriously consider taking it. The Power of Adventure was a TBI production brought to you by Wilbur Smith, the 21st century master of adventure storytelling. Adventure enables self-discovery through direct experience or from the perspective of someone else. Find out more at wilbursmithbooks.com.